Public awareness of medical issues is generally a good thing. However, sometimes when the media gets involved, they go for what makes a good story, not good science. Dr. Philip Sandbrook is professor of rheumatology at the University of Sydney and has research interests in osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, and inflammatory joint disease. In this interview with Dr. Patrick Meany, Philip discusses his concerns over recent coverage of the issue of bisphosphonates and dental care.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. The reason that I wanted to ask you a few questions about Fosamax use is that we've had a lot of information over the last year or so in Australia. And I want to tell you a short story about my experiences in the general practice in a dental setting. And that was that after, I think, the 730 report had a number of specialists on, I was, I'll say, inundated. I must have had 10 or 20 women mainly come and ask me about whether they should stop taking their bisphosphonates. In some of them, I had to plan for some treatment that involved extractions and, in one case, an implant. And I had a lot of tortuous and long discussions with them. But I've got to say, from a low knowledge base, it struck me that maybe there'd been some new information or a new perspective on that scary campaign that took place earlier this year.
Yeah, the 730 report was very scary. And in fact, we, representing the Bone Society in Australia, wrote to the 730 report and the ABC, and they did do a second show, which certainly put it in more balance, and they've acknowledged there were some errors of fact there. But yes, I mean, this is a condition that does occur in people who take bisphosphonates, but there are two settings we have to think about. One is the patients treated for malignancy, and the bisphosphonates are used usually intravenously in very high doses. They seem to actually stop the cancer from spreading, and they can save lives, but the doses are very large. The other setting is usually osteoporosis. Now, in osteoporosis, we're using much smaller doses and the risk is much lower. And I think it's important for people to understand that there is a significant risk in the cancer setting, but the risk in osteoporosis is very low. And I think people got confused after that 730 report about that.
Confused to the extent that the recommendations that dentists were given seemed to be pretty general, and there wasn't that distinction between the two classes. One of the recommendations was that if we had to remove a tooth, for instance, from somebody who was taking bisphosphonates, that we refer them to a dental specialist for care. What's your view of that action?
Well, I'm coming from the medical side. You know, I'm not a dentist, but clearly when we develop some guidelines jointly with the Australian Dental Association, we included that recommendation on the advice of the dentist involved for the more complicated cases. But, you know, we've been using Fosamax now for 12 years in Australia, and many people in that time have had simple dental extractions without any problems. So I would have thought that that recommendation should involve the more complicated cases, but for straightforward cases, that wouldn't be the case.
And would you hazard a guess on where we draw the line for complication? Is it where we're going to suture the site afterwards, or is it implant placement or several teeth removed at once?
I think it's probably those factors, but in particular, a number of risk factors. So we do identify a number of risk factors. If the patients are immunosuppressed, if they're on high doses of corticosteroids, if they've been a smoker, if they've got diabetes, these are all risk factors. I would think probably the greatest one, however, is in the oncology setting, especially if you've got those risk factors. But in the osteoporosis setting, it becomes less of an issue. So depending on the number of risk factors.
So just as a rule of thumb for GPs who are listening to this, could you say that if you have a patient who's taking oral bisphosphonates, they're unlikely to be taking it to suppress a cancer?
That's right. I'm unaware of any approved use of bisphosphonates in an oral setting for cancer. It's, in general, it's an IV dose. We do use oral bisphosphonates for osteoporosis and Paget's disease, but they're both benign bone diseases. The dose in Paget's is a little bit higher, but usually it doesn't continue indefinitely. It's usually for, say, a 6 or 12-month period, and then it stops. So basically, if the patient's on oral doses, they're using it for benign disease, either osteoporosis or Paget's. They're really only getting in oncology when they're using IV doses. I should add that some patients now who can't take oral doses are also using the IV form, but in a once-yearly formulation. So if the patient's on a once-yearly formulation, they could have osteoporosis. But if they're getting it more frequently than that, it's going to be in an oncology setting.
Philip, I've also heard reports that when some of these patients do develop osteonecrosis, that it's almost at a subclinical level. That sure, they've got an area of bone that hasn't healed, but that's not a really big concern for them.
Well, the classical description is of a dry socket that persists. And I think in a lot of people, you're right, this is a subclinical condition that it does settle. I've had a number of people recently, since the 730 report, who have had tooth extractions or stopped their bisphosphonates fairly close to that, whose teeth have healed quite perfectly. I had one patient this week who actually had three teeth removed, one of which was a dry socket for 5 weeks and then resolved. So I think it is often subclinical.
When people kind of treat it like a warfarin therapy, though, I'll stop it 3 or 4 days or a week before the procedure, that really doesn't work because of the long life of these drugs.
That's right. Some of the bisphosphonates, Fosamax in particular, does stay in the skeleton a long time. Some of the other bisphosphonates that we use orally do have a shorter half-life, but even then it would probably take 6 to 12 months for it to disappear from the skeleton. So stopping it a few days before won't have any effect at all.
Philip, I want to take the opportunity to ask you about how GP medicos come to prescribe bisphosphonates. I'm thinking of a woman, one of the ladies that came to see me after these television shows were aired, and she had already had the long consultation with her GP doctor. And she said to me, well, the reason that I was taking it was that I'd had a bone scan and she was about 51, I think, and there was a possibility that she had maybe some early osteoporosis. And she and the GP both decided that maybe it'd be better if she started walking and stopping taking the bisphosphonate. So how early are they being prescribed and do you think they're being overprescribed?
Yeah, we believe, in fact, that bisphosphonates aren't being overprescribed. If we just talk about treatment of osteoporosis in general, one high-risk situation is when you have a low trauma fracture. So if you've had one fracture, you're at risk of another fracture in the next 1 or 2 years. And we know in Australia only about 20% of those patients are receiving treatments such as bisphosphonates for osteoporosis. So we think they're being underprescribed. Certainly, you need to be sure that if the patient gets an active therapy like bisphosphonate, that it is appropriate. That'll usually be after a fracture or with a low bone density. But I would counsel your patient that although we encourage a good calcium intake and regular exercise, you can't achieve the benefit with exercise or calcium that you can with a bisphosphonate. It's mildly effective. It'll lower their risk of having a fall, and it's good for their health generally, but it won't reverse the problem. And if you've got serious osteoporosis, you need a more effective therapy than simple exercise or calcium.
And what about in our older patients? Are there any particular dangers in them contemplating stopping taking bisphosphonates just because of this dental issue?
Well, I think it's important to remind ourselves that although we say osteoporosis is a benign bone disease compared to, say, cancer, in fact, after a hip fracture, about 1 in 5 people will die in the first 6 months. So 20% of patients will die after a hip fracture. And that's not just hip fractures. We know that there's an increased mortality rate after other major types of fractures. And fascinatingly, we have a recent trial that shows that if you give a bisphosphonate after a hip fracture, you can reduce that mortality rate. So I think there is a significant mortality and morbidity associated with osteoporotic fractures, and these treatments appear to be able to reduce that. So it is an important condition. And if someone comes off their therapy for a perception of a risk that's quite low and then has a fracture and sustains a major complication or even dies, well, then they haven't got the balance of the risk-benefit right, have they?
I agree. Can I take you back to the statistical basis of any concern that there might be? I'm no statistician, but can you break it down in simple language? If you have a patient that's been taking bisphosphonates for, say, 5 years, and I go and place an implant or I remove a tooth, what's the likelihood that they're going to have a complication?
Well, first of all, the risk of getting this condition is pretty low in the first 3 years. So you probably have to take it for quite a number of years before the risk starts to rise. The international experience, and this has been looked at in a number of countries, suggests that the overall risk is about 1 in 100,000. Now, if you have a tooth extraction, that obviously increases the risk. But even then, it probably comes down to about 1 in 10,000.
So the 1 in 100,000 is you don't do anything and you may have an oral complication, is it?
That's right. So if you look at all people taking bisphosphonates, the reported prevalence, if you like, of this incidence is, in fact, 1 in 100,000. Whether we think about whether they're having a tooth extraction or not, that's the total population. But then if you reduce that to say, okay, let's take people who are on bisphosphonates who are having a tooth extraction, then that does increase the risk, and it's probably about 1 in 10,000. That's the international experience. In Australia, a study that was done as a postal questionnaire, the risk appeared to be higher, but I think the authors of that acknowledged that because it was a retrospective postal questionnaire and the cases weren't validated, that those figures should be viewed with caution. The overall risk from the international literature, a number of studies around the world, is more like 1 in 100,000 and then 1 in 10,000.
Are there any other places where you get the same problems apart from the oral cavity?
Not with bisphosphonates. In fact, it's interesting, but we think that bisphosphonates might be an effective way of treating osteonecrosis in the hip, for example, or in other sites. And certainly that's what we call an off-label use. People have been doing that for some time. So if you get osteonecrosis at other sites in the skeleton, at the hip or the knee, there is a vogue for actually using bisphosphonates, and the evidence suggests they may actually promote healing and prevent that complication. We're about to start a study of that, seeing if we can actually prove it in a randomized trial. So the bisphosphonates are often used as a treatment for osteonecrosis in other settings outside the jaw. So it's probably a different pathology. And what we've really got here is not just the effect of the bisphosphonates, but the additional effect of bacterial infection. It's obviously the only site in the skeleton where the bone is not only having the effect of bisphosphonate, but is being exposed to bacterial challenge.
I'm just smiling that you can use bisphosphonates to treat osteonecrosis. Can you imagine putting this rather complex scenario across the table to a television presenter?
It's difficult to explain this, and it's quite a complicated condition. And I guess that was what I found disappointing about the 730 report, because one thing that the patient needs to understand is the different risk profile, for example, between cancer and osteoporosis. And if that's not clear, then people get scared inappropriately. But then if you look at the overall evidence, yeah, it's difficult to say, okay, well, there is possibly an increased risk of this in the jaw, and yet we might use it to treat it if you've got it somewhere else. Most patients would struggle to understand it. Unless you understand the pathophysiology, most doctors would struggle to understand it.
Well, I think you're doing a pretty good job of explaining it. Tell me, I just want to make the point with you that when people are taking IV bisphosphonates, it's for a pretty serious reason, and if they don't take them, they're in a bad way.
Well, certainly when you're having the monthly or more frequent doses of IV, this is usually people with breast cancer, multiple myeloma. It does, there are studies showing that they reduce the risk of skeletal events, including spread to the bone. And so this can be life-saving. So that's a pretty serious condition. What has changed recently, and that the dentists need to be aware of, is that the much less frequent administration of IV doses, namely once yearly, has now been proven in these trials to be also effective in osteoporosis. So certainly in people who can't take oral bisphosphonates, we're now saying that a once yearly injection of an IV formulation seems to be as effective, and in certain situations perhaps more effective. So that's an area of active research. But some patients with osteoporosis will get intravenous injections of a bisphosphonate, but it'll be once a year. So it's a much lower dose than we see in the oncology setting.
Well, in 2008, Philip, where do you think we stand with this issue? I'm particularly interested in how our medical colleagues are coping and what their advice has been.
I've seen lots of patients coming back, especially since the 730 report, who have been on bisphosphonates for significant osteoporosis for a number of years, who have stopped their medication inappropriately. And when I've explained it to them, they have actually understood the benefits and the risks, and they're quite comfortable with them. But I'm sure that's not the case in many situations, and I know that a lot of general practitioners have been even more inundated because they have more patients. So my concern is that dentists understand that, yes, there are benefits and risks, but the benefits are quite large, and that if people stop their therapy, they may have unfortunate complications, including an increased risk of death. So I think it's important that the whole picture be looked at, and that the fact that this is a low risk is understood before the dentist says to the patient, well, I can't do that procedure unless you stop it, which I think may be the case in certain situations, but you need some balance in this whole picture.
Well, Philip, I really appreciate you talking to us today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.